Here is a special announcement. Today is Tuesday, and not, as is announced in today's Sunday Telegraph, Friday. And now, a repeat of last Thursday's performance of Monday Night is Music Night.
Here we are back together sharing our evening under lamplight on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson and I invite you to attend. Now, first, a little administrative announcement. The station is changing its internet and email identity from .fm, FM being sort of a marginalising label now, I'm told, over to .co.uk. So when you come to the web page, look for cambridge105.co.uk. And when you write to me at my radio address, use lamplight at cambridge105.co.uk. But now don't panic if you continue to use the old address with .fm. Hey, you'll still get through. Our arms are open to you however you come to us. You know that. On our last show, we spoke about Dante's depiction of the seducers and panders, but there was a lot of material I had to abandon because there just wasn't time. I sort of promised last time that we'd make room on this show to include some of that extra material, and that's just what we'll do. So stay tuned for more songs, poems, and stories about seduction. But before we move to all this, we have something special on the show this evening, Under Lamplight, something we don't often do. We're honored to be able to present for you the debut radio appearance of a new song, produced by a former student of mine who asked if I'd be interested in bringing this song onto the show. And why not? I'm not sure that the song is about seduction, but there's certainly some kind of fraud going on, I think. So it may fit into this part of Dante's Inferno. The song is called It Hurts, and the writer and singer is Rukeya, who brings a dual cultural heritage of both German and Moroccan roots. She grew up in the multicultural city of Hamburg, but has been living in London since 2011. Her inspirations and, I'm reading what she's told me anyway, her inspirations and musical influences reach from soul to R&B, hip-hop, mainly French and English, rye music from North Africa, Moroccan Berber music, chansons and classical music. Well, that's pretty wide. Attend to the way these different threads weave into the song. Rukeya sings over and over that it hurts. What hurts? The way he treats her is what hurts. He seems to want her, but he doesn't seem to notice or care that she is suffering when he keeps going back to his old life. All sorts of possibilities here about what that old life might be. No need to go into detail. We can play with possibilities ourselves. So what does he want? When will he make up his mind? Everyone thinks he's pretty cool, judging from the outside, and thus he falls into the sin of hypocrisy, which we'll learn more about very soon in the Inferno. But although he puts on a carefree appearance, she knows that he's not sleeping so well at night, and he's tormented about whether he's doing the right thing. There's no room for lies now. He can't avoid the pain. It hurts, applies to him even more than to her, we suspect. And this is his place in the inferno. Maybe it's deceit, in other words, fraud, especially if he's lying to the public world, to her, and to himself. Or maybe he belongs to those people we saw at the very beginning, the pusillanimi, the ones who never committed themselves to anything and now are running furiously in the vestibule of hell, stung by wasps, their woeful tears mixing with their blood, falling in puddles where maggots are squirming. Okay, Rukia, I know you didn't write the song to illustrate Dante's Inferno, but everything takes on meaning depending on its context, and here's your song appearing now in the context of our time spent with Dante. But look, the song is much more than the words, important though they may be. Attend to Rukia's voice and the rocking music, the guitar, electric cello and percussion, not pushing themselves forward, but I think discreetly building up the emotional background. I suppose what they're doing is setting up a resonance that accompanies the words to bring us into a harmonic sympathy with the whole feel of the song. So listen, here's Rukia, It Hurts.
Baby, it's love.
That was Rukia, It Hurts. There's something like a mesmerizing chant about it towards the end. The song was produced by Pivotal, who can be followed and or contacted on Instagram at Pivotal the Wizard. Rukia also has a YouTube channel, so find her there, Rukeia. Or Facebook or Instagram at Rukia Official. Or SoundCloud, you know, all those social media. The song will soon be available to everyone, and I'll let you know more at the time. And thanks, Henri, for letting us come together with this track here on Evening Under Lamplight. And now let's get back to Dante at the bolgia, or ditch, of seducers and panders. Remember, we're in the area of fraud, the most heinous sin in Dante's world, the kind of deceit that undermines the very foundations of community, promoting pain and distrust. We are, of course, now living in the midst of a fraudulent world, with alternative facts coming to us, not just from politicians and pseudo-politicians, let's admit, but also from the press, from the social media, and, as always, from our own inner voices. We need to attend to the workings of fraud now more than ever. The seducers and panders specifically destroy community by using others for their own satisfaction, by playing on their victims' passions, in particular in Dante's depiction, by playing on their sexual arousal, creating a fraudulent relationship between two people. I pretend that I love you so I can get you to surrender to me, and then I can pleasure myself with your body and then leave you when I'm finished. But seduction is not just on a sexual plane. As we heard Dorothy Sayers say last time, seduction is not just sexual, but involves the stimulation and exploitation of every kind of passion, such as rage or greed, by which one may make tools of other people. And that's the key, making tools of other people. Thus, advertising can seduce us with its bright colors and lively music, making us tools as we give them our money. So too can films and television shows, all arousing our passion for excitement. And there are lots of other ways people seduce others, which we may get a chance to look at. Now remember, these sinners, like almost everyone else in hell, are naked, signifying that we are seeing the sin for what it really is. So here are the seducers and panders caught in a circular trench, going round and round, getting nowhere, and being whipped along by taunting demons, representing, I suppose, the way that once seducers and panders start on their course, they become caught in their perverse need to find pleasure only by stirring up others' passions. And then this need keeps whipping them over and over. I mean, you don't find a seducer doing it just once and going off to do something else, do you? We find, don't we, that the seducer becomes a serial seducer, needing the thrill of this deceitful game. That's their pain. Rukia's guy doesn't seem to be in that position quite. He doesn't seem to have enough commitment for this. But here's another song about it's hurting. If I gave you the line, and it hurts so bad, will you recognize what song I'm referring to? Yes, that's right, The Supremes. Where did our love go? It's the third of the three Motown songs I wanted to include on the last show but ran out of time. The song takes us into the broken heart of someone who's been deceived by a seducer. He led her on with a hurting love that stings like a bee. That's a kind of sexual arousal, after all, though the zing soon turns from a thrill to a painful ache. And as soon as she surrenders so helplessly, then he wants to leave her. Where did our love go? All of your promises of a love forevermore. Was it ever love or just deception? And here's the seducer's trademark. Before you won my heart, you were a perfect guy. But now that you've got me, you want to leave me behind. Yes, poor thing. You now want to leave me all by myself. No community. That's hell for you. Ooh, baby, baby. Well, it was one of the Motown features to highlight the beats, a way to arouse the listener's excitement, a method of seducing them into a passionate surrender to the song. And so here we get that opening beat. My amateur ear couldn't tell if it is the sound of feet stomping, as on a dance floor, or hands clapping, or something else, but Henri, a percussion guy, assures me that it begins with snare drum hits, and then a tiny drum fill in one of the toms of a drum kit. That's technical, drum talk. It's the official word. It's a bit scratchy. I'm playing it from an old vinyl album, Motown Big Hits 5. The first Motown record I bought, I think. It's a great collection, but I played it over and over, Lang Syne, and vinyl has a way of not doing so well after so many plays. Still, it gives you some kind of authentic sound. Here it is. Remember to catch that snare drum at the start. And so it goes. The Supremes, Where Did Our Love Go? Last time I mentioned that seduction was a common theme in older poetry, and it wasn't just men seducing women. Shakespeare's long poem Venus and Adonis features Venus's attempt to seduce Adonis. Although Venus, goddess of love, must be the sexiest being around, Adonis isn't interested and would rather go off hunting instead. The modern equivalent would be the guy who'd rather play basketball or football or sit and watch the sports on television. At one point, I recall Venus, who, after all, is a goddess, picks up Adonis in one arm and picks up his horse in the other arm and marches off with them. This is no longer seduction, which means deceit, but it's force, that is, rape. But then the Greek deities are like that. I mentioned briefly last time that perhaps the most famous seduction poem in English was Andrew Marvell's To His Coy Mistress. She's a coy mistress or lady, meaning that she's modest or shy, especially in these circumstances, by not responding to someone's advances. The poem begins pretty clearly a few minutes after he's made his advances, and she's been coy and refused the advances. "That's okay," he says. "If we had world enough and time, this coyness, lady, would be no crime. I could play this game all day long, if there was time, but there isn't time. At my back I always hear time's winged chariot hurrying near. We're getting older each minute, and soon we'll die." A warning, we're about to talk about death and decaying bodies. "Thy beauty," he says, "thy beauty shall no more be found. It will be destroyed by death, and you'll be in your grave. Then worms shall try that long-preserved virginity. That is, I may not be able to break your virginity, but those phallic worms are going to penetrate you. You'll lose your virginity anyway when those worms get to work on you. You might as well lose it now while you can enjoy it and while you can give me the pleasure, too." And then this great line, "The grave's a fine and private place, but none, I think, do there embrace." So he concludes, "Let's enjoy it while we can." And actually, as perhaps you see, it's not really a poem about seduction, even though he's trying to get her into bed with him. No, and this is what makes it great poetry. It's got a deeper theme about the nature of the world, in particular about the way all beauty fades. And so why save up? Why be stingy? We must somehow let go and enjoy the beauty of the world while we can.
Lay down. Let's explore this tenderness between us. There ain't no one around at all to see us. Baby, would you mind if maybe you and I took a little time to find each other? Baby, we got all the time in the world, so why don't we just take it nice and slow? We got everything we need to plant a loving seed, and all the time we need to watch it grow. Stay down, stay. Stay at least until the fire stops burning. At least until the room has stopped its turning. And when the embers dying low, we're lying in the afterglow. It'll be as sweet as anything we've ever known. Baby, we got all the time in the world, so why don't we just take it nice and slow? We got everything we need to plant a loving seed, and all the time we need to watch it grow. So why don't we just take it nice and slow? We got everything we need to plant a loving seed, and all the time we need to watch it grow. Baby, we got all the time in the world, so why don't we just take it?
So for Dr. Hook, we got all the time in the world, so why don't we just take it slow? He's in no rush. He does not feel time's winged chariot hurrying down upon him. But what's going on? He starts off saying, lay down. And the English teacher in me bridles at that. Of course, it should be lie down, but never mind. Is she trying to get out of there, and is he trying to persuade her to stay? Let's explore this tenderness between us, he says. See, no threat, just some exploration. And, baby, would you mind if maybe you and I took a little time to find each other? Who could resist? We're all lonely, all in search of ourselves, and here he's offering her this delicate invitation. The second verse begins, "Stay down." Uh-huh. She accepted his invitation and lay down with him, but now wants to get up, it appears. "But please," he says, "stay at least until the fire stops burning, at least until the room has stopped its turning, and when the embers dying low, we're lying in the afterglow, it'll be as sweet as anything we've ever known." Now, is this seduction? Well, the question is whether he seems to be deceiving her, using her. He sounds genuine, but then that's what all good seducers sound like. But the more I attend, the more I think he is genuine. It's no slam-bam, thank you, ma'am. He wants to linger with her. That's relationship, community, not seduction and fraud. And Dennis Locorio's voice here really does seem so tender. And yes, it's a Shel Silverstein song, so it's not going to be straightforward anyway.
Let's explore this tenderness between us. There ain't no one around at all to see us. And baby, would you mind if maybe you and I took a little time to find each other? All the time we need to watch it grow. Stay down,
stay.
Stay at least until the fire stops burning. At least until the room has stopped its turning. And when the embers die low, we're lying in the afterglow. It'll be as sweet as anything we've ever known. Baby, we are...
But it's all very well for Dr. Hook. But we here at Evening Under Lamplight haven't, as you know, got all the time in the world. We're here for this 1 hour on Cambridge 105, me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, and you, who are attending, and attending to, all the poems, songs, and stories we're looking at this evening, basically following Dante's image of seduction. And speaking of seduction, here's the seductive voice of our man, Neil Henry.
When the day comes to an end, he invites you to attend Evening Under Lamplight. It's Cambridge 105.
Tomorrow, of course, is Burns' night, and wouldn't it be appropriate if I included one of Burns' seduction songs? There must be plenty, since he wrote so many songs about sexual games between men and women. But when I looked through Burns' songs, I could find no real seduction songs. There are lots of songs about lads meeting bonny lasses on the road or at the fair or elsewhere and the two of them falling doon together with a wee bit pleasure. But as far as I can tell, there's no deceit about it. Thus, it's not seduction. They may be up there with Dante's lustful, but not down here with the practitioners of fraud. The laddie and lassie baith ken what they're doing. They're quite honest that they're just looking to enjoy the pleasures of sex. There are some songs where she then becomes pregnant and is left on her own. Oh, I had tint, I have lost my rosy cheek, likewise my waist so small, away by the soldier loon, the soldier did it all. And now he's avoided responsibility by going off with the army. But that's not deceit, just cowardice. And Burns himself, we know, did not deny the barons he got. He was a flirt and an uncle laddie, but there's no demonic whipping around the infernal circles for him. His heart was far too generous, if also fallible. So let's move on to something else. Now, I wanted to talk about this story last time, but we didn't, as you know, have all the time in the world. And Time's winged chariot, in the form of the 5 or 6 clocks here in the studio, pressed us too hard. You'll recall that we attended to the Marvelettes' song, The Hunter Gets Captured by the Game, a song about this seducer, we might even call her a stalker, who finally gets him to embrace her, but at that moment she looks up and knows that it's she who's been captured. What's this old world coming to, she laments. Things just ain't the same any time the hunter gets captured by the game. Well, here's a story about the hunter getting captured by the game, or the seducer being seduced. It's Flannery O'Connor's 1955 short story, Good Country People. But I'm defeated when I attempt to provide even a short summary of the story, and so I'll do nothing of the kind. I'll just read you the moment when the hunter gets captured by the game. Another problem about reading a Flannery O'Connor story out loud is that it is so funny in places, and these places suddenly jump out at us, so funny that I can't read it without breaking down in laughter. But the part we'll be looking at here is not really the funny part of the story, but rather the part where the story shifts into full-blown Southern Gothic horror. Also, spiritual allegory, but you'll see what I mean in a minute. The main character is Joy, though she has changed her name to Holga, mostly because she knows it will annoy her mother, who thinks it's the ugliest name in the world. Holga is an atheist with a PhD in philosophy. I've got to shift to that kind of Southern accent now. She's an atheist with a PhD in philosophy. She has a heart condition and isn't expected to live long, and she also has an artificial leg because of a childhood accident. Holga feels superior to everyone around her on the southern farm she lives on with her mother. And her sense of superiority is especially provoked when a nice young man, Good Country People, as her mother infuriatingly insists on calling him, shows up at their door selling Bibles. He is full of bright innocence and Christian virtue. Holga hits on the idea that she'll seduce this boy and show him that having sex with her is no sin at all. In fact, there's nothing in life. Sin is a fabrication. She's going to seduce his mind more than his body and turn him into a nihilist like herself. We want to watch as she moves from that life-denying, bitter mind of hers into, finally, an openness to the wonder and mystery of the world. They arrange to meet later on, and they walk together across the fields. He suddenly puts his hand on her back and drew her against him without a word and kissed her heavily. We are moving towards the climax of the story. The kiss, which had more pressure than feeling behind it and produced that extra surge of adrenaline in the girl that enables one to carry a packed trunk out of a burning house. But in her, the power went at once to the brain. Even before he released her, her mind, clear and detached and ironic anyway, was regarding him from a great distance, with amusement, but with pity. She had never been kissed before, and she was pleased to discover that it was an unexceptional experience, and all a matter of the mind's control. I mean, some people might enjoy drain water if they were told it was vodka. When the body, looking expectant but uncertain, pushed her gently away, she turned and walked on, saying nothing, as if such business for her were common enough. They come to an old barn and climb up the ladder to the hayloft, the boy still carrying his valise containing his Bible samples. We won't need the Bible, she says. You never can tell, he answers. Once up in the hayloft, the Bible salesman began methodically kissing her face, making little noises like a fish. He did not remove his hat, but it was pushed far enough back not to interfere. When her glasses got in his way, he took them off her and slipped them into his pocket. The girl at first did not return any of the kisses, but presently she began to, and after she had put several on his cheek, she reached his lips and remained there, kissing him again and again as if she were trying to draw all the breath out of him. His breath was clear and sweet like a child's, and the kisses were sticky like a child's. He mumbled about loving her and about knowing when he first seen her that he loved her, but the mumbling was like the sleepy fretting of a child being put to sleep by his mother. Her mind throughout this never stopped or lost itself for a second to her feelings. "You ain't said you love me none," he whispered finally, pulling back from her. "You gotta say that." And that's the seducer's line, isn't it? The seducer is never happy until he or she gets the other person to surrender voluntarily, in this case, by saying that she loves him. He pushes her further, and finally she says, yes, yes, she does love him. "Okay, then," he says, "prove it." Well, the way most seducers want their victim to prove it is, of course, by taking off their clothes. But this young Bible salesman is a little different. He wants her to prove it by, ready? By showing him where her artificial leg joins her real leg. Yes, well, this is just a different way to get her where she's most vulnerable, isn't it? Her wooden leg is something she's really sensitive about, but he assures her that the wooden leg is what makes you different. You ain't like anybody else. She decided that for the first time in her life, she was face to face with real innocence. This boy, with an instinct that came from beyond wisdom, had touched the truth about her. When after a minute she said in a hoarse, high voice, "All right," it was like surrendering to him completely. It was like losing her own life and finding it again, miraculously, in his. If we're alert, by the way, we'll realize that this is the relationship one is meant to have with God, surrendering your own life and finding it again miraculously in his. So he begins to roll up her trouser leg, and then he asks her to show how she takes it off, and then how she puts it on. And then he takes it off himself. "Put it back on," she says. "Well, not yet," he says, and places the leg out of her reach. "Leave it off for a while," he says. "You got me instead." She gave a little cry of alarm, but he pushed her down and began to kiss her again. Without the leg, she felt entirely dependent on him. Her brain seemed to have stopped thinking altogether and to be about some other function that it was not very good at. Different expressions raced back and forth over her face. And then the boy opens his valise. It had a pale blue spotted lining, and there were only two Bibles in it. He took one of these out and opened the cover of it. It was hollow and contained a pocket flask of whiskey, a pack of cards, and a small blue box with printing on it. He laid these out in front of her, one at a time, in an evenly spaced row, like one presenting offerings at the shrine of a goddess. He put the blue box in her hand. "This product to be used only for the prevention of disease. That is, it contains condoms." She read this and she dropped it. The boy was unscrewing the top of the flask. He stopped and pointed with a smile to the deck of cards. It was not an ordinary deck, but one with an obscene picture on the back of each card. "Take a swig," he said, offering her the bottle first. He held it in front of her, but like one mesmerized, she did not move. "Come on now, let's begin to have us a good time," he says. "We ain't got to know one another good yet." But she backs away and demands her leg again. "Give me my leg," she screamed, and tried to lunge for it, but he pushed her down easily. "What's the matter with you all of a sudden?" he asked, frowning as he screwed the top on the flask and put it quickly back inside the Bible. "You just a while ago said you didn't believe in nothing. I thought you was some girl." She shouts at him, You're a fine Christian. You're just like them all. Say one thing and do another. You're a perfect Christian. You're... The boy's mouth was set angrily. I hope you don't think, he said in a lofty, indignant tone, that I believe in that crap. I may sell Bibles, but I know which end is up, and I wasn't born yesterday, and I know where I'm going. Give me my leg, she screeches, but he gets up, gathers the cards and the box of condoms back into the Bible, and grabs her leg and puts it into the valise along with the Bibles. Then he climbs down the ladder. Just before he disappears down the ladder, he says, I've gotten a lot of interesting things. One time I got a woman's glass eye this way. And I'll tell you another thing. You ain't so smart. I've been believing in nothing ever since I was born. And then he's gone. And Holga, stunned out of her mind, literally out of her mind, and into her heart, or her soul, and not able to see very clearly without her glasses, looks out the window and saw his blue figure struggling successfully over the green speckled meadow, which, without her glasses, looked to her like a lake. So what's happened? Like so many of Flannery's characters, she has suffered some kind of violence which has thrown her out of the self-assured certainties in her head and opened her to the wider world of mystery and wonder. The Bible salesman disappears, walking on water like Jesus. Whatever his own diabolical aims, he has come to her as an agent of redemption. This is a happy ending, though you might not at first have thought so. Sometimes your angel comes as a man of violence. But then, of course, sometimes Satan comes as a man of peace. That was Bob Dylan, of course, Man of Peace. Flannery O'Connor's satanic figures always come as agents of redemption. Dylan, in his evangelical phase, probably couldn't see that. Grace comes to us, Flannery knew from her own experience, comes to us most frequently and most effectively in moments of great violence, destroying all our ego's certainties and smugness. Now, for our final piece, I suggest this classic seduction song, or seduction gone wrong song, Paradise by the Dashboard Light, from Jim Steinman's Bat Out of Hell, sung, of course, by Meatloaf. Hey man, don't let your meatloaf, as we used to say in Philadelphia. And let's send this out for Barry, liaising between Jim Steinman back in America and the director and production team in London, as they rehearse the new stage musical of Bat Out of Hell, which opens at the Manchester Opera House on 17th of February and moves to the London Coliseum on the 5th of June. And now, at last, after I don't want to say how many years, is the stage production of the show Jim and Barry first produced when we were undergraduates at Amherst College. It is, as the overexcited trailer tells me, an epic tale of love, rebellion, and rock and roll. Paradise by the Dashboard Light is the longest track on the original album. It's a song about teenage seduction. but like all of Steinman's songs, with a twist that makes it, well, let's do a trailer here, makes it an epic tale of teenage hormones, tantalizing sexuality, and uptight repression. But it's also not a straightforward song. It comes to us through an odd perspective, as a story being told from the future, looking back to long ago and far away. That subset of the American dream for teenagers who think they own the world, but are really just obeying social and biological forces beyond themselves. He says he remembers everything as if it was yesterday. Yeah, because this one moment of pseudo-seduction has changed his whole life and made it hell. He's no bat out of hell, but let's say he's like a bat flying blindly trapped in hell. He's not a practiced seducer, just some horny adolescent whose hormones and teenage culture have whipped him into thinking that if he scores with this teenage queen, then all the kids at school will be wishing they were me that night. I suppose that's the demonic whip, this desire to be envied by all the guys at school. So the scene. They're parked in the car at night by the lake, presumably in the summer, and so, presumably, we're to picture them in typical American teenage summer wear, shorts, bare legs, bare feet, a T-shirt or less. No wonder, as she says, we were doubly blessed. We were barely 17 and we were barely dressed. And there's a line designed to seduce all teenagers listening to the song. We were doubly blessed. We were barely 17 and we were barely dressed. He's out to score. What is she out for? We'll see. So they start making out. It never felt so good and never felt so right, glowing like the metal on the edge of a knife. If we had to pick one line most typical of Steinman's style, it might be that one. Glowing like the metal on the edge of a knife. Sensational, dangerous, but frustrated in the end. Well, it may be cold and lonely in the deep, dark night outside by the lake, but he says he can see paradise by the dashboard light. They're entwined together in the dark, but they have the radio on, of course. And he can catch seductive glimpses of her by the lights on the dashboard. I suppose she's just expecting to make out, like she always does with boys down here at the lake. But he wants to seduce her into going all the way, and he has the seduction lines all prepared. You got my heart drowning out the radio, he says. You're never going to regret it, he says. I got a big surprise, it'll feel all right, he says. So, as he puts it, he does what he can and lets Mother Nature do the rest. The seducer's ploy to get her worked up until she's so hot she'll do whatever you want. And then they can really start going at it. But wait, what's on the radio? It's not the Marvelettes or the Supremes, but a New York Yankees baseball game? Yes, and it's the legendary Phil Rizzuto with the commentary, not just on what's going on in the baseball game, but bringing to life the adolescent metaphor of scoring with a girl depicted as the activity of rounding the bases in baseball. He knows they're going to ask him the next day at school whether he scored a home run out of the lake, and it looks like he's going to. He's rounding third and slides into home plate. Is he safe? No. Stop right there, she says. Before we go any further, I want to know, do you love me? Will you make me happy for the rest of my life? Will you take me away and will you make me your wife? What? What's this part of it? He thought it was just a question of his getting his way with her body tonight. What have love or Vesemir marriage got to do with it? He says he wants to sleep on it. Presumably sleeping on top of her, another Steinman touch to bring a dead metaphor to life. But now she has the upper hand and keeps pressing, what's it going to be, boy? Not a come-on line, but certainly a power line, and she knows he's not a man but a boy, that is, manipulable. But then so is she, manipulated by the girl's fantasy of a happy marriage. He's now gone so far he'll do anything to get into home base. So he swears by God and on his mother's grave that he'll love her forever. He'll love her till the end of time. And then presumably she consents and he gets his home run. Hope he enjoys it. But now, who has seduced whom? And for what benefit? Because we now shift to the present, after they've been married for some time. 10 years, 1 year, 1 month, 3 days. And all he can do is pray for the end of time to hurry up and arrive so he can at last be free from her. For some reason, he feels he has to be faithful to that oath he made. That doesn't seem plausible, but we're not meant to think about that. Bat Out of Hell is one of the best-selling albums of all time. Have all those adolescents been seduced by this sexy scene in the car? Or does it resonate, perhaps, with their fear of all kinds of commitment? It certainly chimes with Dante. They hate each other now. There's no relationship, no community. And they're constantly whipped by the memory of that night by the lake. It was long ago, and it was far away, and it was so much better than it is today. Yes, most people in the Inferno will say that too. Well, here's Steinman's Wagner-esque operatic treatment of this little episode.
Before we go any further, do you love me? Will you love me forever? Do you need me? Will you never leave me? Will you make me so happy for the rest of my life? Will you take me away? Will you make me away? Do you love me? Let me sleep on it, baby, baby, let me sleep on it. Let me sleep on it, I'll give you an answer in the morning. Let me sleep on it, baby, baby, let me sleep on it.